Welcome to a special Money Matters series on coronavirus, COVID-19. We've been way out front in speaking to the foremost medical experts and public policy experts, public health experts, to try to understand when we get a hold of the disease and the virus, and when we start seeing cases come down, when we get testing to the point it needs to be in America, because we know that certainty through testing will lead to our ability to kind of get back to work in America and be able to get through this or put this at least partially behind us. I think we'll forever be changed. And one of the biggest issues that we've had as a nation, where we've been caught flat-footed as a nation, has to do with testing and really around the public health response to COVID-19. With me today, Dr. Joe Antos from AEI, the American Enterprise Institute. He is a Wilson Taylor scholar in healthcare and retirement policy, and really just one of the nation's foremost experts on how we are responding to this as a nation and a problem. And I wanted to bring him on the show today to get some frontline advice on where we stand and how we're going to continue to get better at this, really, as we go through what will be a tenuous month of April, trying to get COVID-19 at least partially behind us. So, Joe, thank you so much. Welcome to the show. I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Wes. It's great to be here.
And you can tweet Joe. He is at Joe Antos, at Joeantos, for your tweets. And of course, my Twitter at WesMoss365, WesMoss.com. Let's go over kind of the four-step process that the AEI has kind of laid out. I know Scott Gottlieb's talked about this. Can you walk us through that? Because obviously testing is a big part of that. And I know that very recently we're getting good news. We've been calling good news, by the way, baby white swans, because we've been hit with this massive black swan, and we've been on the search for baby white swans. It took a while, by the way, to get any baby white swans, and now all of a sudden I'm waking up and I'm hearing, oh, Abbott Labs has a sub 15-minute test, and if you're positive, it's, you know, within 5 minutes. If you're negative, you have to wait 15. That's a baby white swan. That's good news. If, you know, Johnson & Johnson now has going into trial very quickly on a vaccine, that's good news. Regeneron working on this antiviral or treatment that could be tested as early as June. I mean, these are all pieces of good news that start happening when, I know, we were faced with a tsunami of terrible news. And we're starting to see now a small bevy of these baby white swans as the good news started to grow. So let's maybe walk through that four-step
plan. Right. The first step, which we're in now, and we're struggling with it, is to slow the spread. That's where this idea of social distancing is really critically important. You know, we have CDC reported for the end of March about 140,000 cases. In Georgia, I know you're broadcasting from Georgia. At the end of March, there were 2,700 cases. That's a lot of cases, by the way. In the Midwest, in the states that are more rural in nature, they're beginning to see some cases, but nothing like the instance we're seeing in the big cities on the East Coast or the big cities on the West Coast. It's coming. There's no question about it. So the critical issue is social distancing, and you know by the height of the buildings in the downtown areas how successful that's going to be. It is no coincidence that New York is being hard hit, because their apartment buildings are 40 or 50 stories tall. In cities with a less grand scale, people can live further apart, or the suburbs, people are living further apart. Social distancing is more feasible in those areas. In places like New York City, it's very, very difficult, and they're going to see the worst of it, and it's going to take a very long time. But for many of us, if we just are smart enough not to go running around having parties in the backyard with all of our friends, and don't go to the supermarket every day, and wash our hands, we'll be we'll be doing the right thing, not only for ourselves, but for everybody else in our community. So that's the first step. And by the way, Scott's plan does not predict how long we're going to get through, these various phases, but the phases, in my view, make sense. That's the first phase. Everybody knows about that one.
Right. First phase, slowing the spread, continue to do social distancing. That's an interesting point, but I think it makes a lot of sense. Height of the building is in direct proportion to the number of cases, because it's just harder to distance when you have 1,000 people in the building all touching the same elevator buttons versus a rural community in Georgia where you've got a farm and you've got 4 people living on the farm and the next farm isn't for a half a mile. So that makes a lot of sense to Americans, but I think that's a really good first thought. Number two. Yeah.
So number two is state-by-state reopening. Now, this is something that President Trump has in mind, no question about it. I think Scott has the right idea with his plan. You need a wide enough geographic area to open up so that it makes sense. And he doesn't say this. He has the affliction of being merely a physician, whereas I'm merely an economist, but I think in economics terms. You want a sensible area in terms of the way the local economy works.
Like a region, if you will.
A region, right, exactly. So, of course, it's going to be the main city, but it's also going to be the suburbs. And then you kind of want to think about how far much further out you go, and especially I live in the greater Washington, D.C. area, so that's a particularly good question here. It's 50 miles to Baltimore. It's 50 miles to Frederick, Maryland, another fairly large town in Maryland. And then we have the suburbs in Virginia. How far do you want to open it up? Clearly, in our area, if you're going to open up, it's going to be the District of Columbia. It's going to be part of Maryland. It's going to be part of Virginia. And those actions have to be coordinated across 3 state governments. So I'm a little worried about that, quite honestly.
Now, Joe, let me ask you this. So I guess we're already past the thought. I mean, if we could rewind and potentially just be really early and proactive, let's say all the way back to February 15th or March 1st, where we just shut everybody down for 30 days and did a really intense job of doing this. And we did it to our full might in a coordinated way. Maybe we do it for 30 days. We did it for 45 days. It's, to some extent, is it too late because we've kind of done these rolling shutdowns and most people have done it, but not everyone. We've done kind of a quasi-quarantine. Is it now? You guys are not even talking about shutdown. You're already talking about reopening.
In the second phase, the critical element is that we have to have enough testing to know where we are on the infection scale. Scott's recommendation, which I think is very sensible. There are other ways you can do this, but Scott's recommendation is you have to have, maybe not universal testing, but you have to have intensive testing of a lot of people, including people who do not immediately show symptoms, so that we can know who's infected and who's likely to be a carrier and who's likely to be a so-called super spreader. And once you get to the point, when you're measuring this on a regular basis, when you get to the point where the number of people who are infected begins to drop and begins to drop significantly over say a 2-week period, then you can have reasonable confidence that you can start to look at reopening, again, a sensible economic area in your state. Not the whole state necessarily, but a sensible area depending on price on testing. It's all dependent on knowing where you are. Right now, we don't know where we are, but once we're getting there.
So let's go to number three now. So state-by-state reopening through intensive testing. And then what's the third step?
The third step is establishing immunity across the country. This won't happen until we have an effective vaccine. That vaccine, they're working on it. There's speculation that we might have a vaccine as early next year, which is at the speed of light. Let's hope that's the case. But what This third stage is critically important, because when we get to that point, then physical distancing can be lifted. If we have enough people, it's basically akin to the polio vaccine, the measles and mumps vaccine. If you get enough people vaccinated, then we get something called herd immunity. Ideally, we want everybody to be vaccinated, and we would like the vaccine to be very, very effective. Now, vaccination is a good idea. Vaccines are not 100% effective. Vaccines have adverse consequences, and they can be serious for some people. The goal is to increase the effectiveness of the vaccine, minimize the side effects, and identify the patients who have either genetic or other physical characteristics that tell you that they shouldn't get the vaccine because it might be disastrous for them. That's all part of the clinical testing. They're really ramping up unbelievably quickly. We need to be careful, though. We need to be very careful. And if FDA says we're not ready, we should believe them.
And then number four.
Number four is going to be the part that is going to be the hardest in some sense, because the crisis will be over. And number four is prepare for the next pandemic. Now, I have to say that this is where an economist, me, and a physician, Scott, probably part ways. Mm-hmm. The problem is not that we don't have good intentions. The problem is that we get back to a normal economy and a normal health sector, we have a lot of other demands for our resources. And so the criticism that people are making now, that we don't have enough ventilators, it's a failure of planning. We don't have enough hospital beds in New York City in particular. I find this to be, sadly humorous. Of course, we don't have enough hospitals in New York, hospital beds in New York. You couldn't have enough hospital beds in New York for the crisis we are in now. So yes.
Because there's 12 million people, because there's 10 million people. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And there isn't enough empty space in New York City to put as many hospital beds as you would want for the most extreme case, which is where we are now. So the way an economist would look at it is that we want to prepare for an emergency, but not for the worst thing anybody ever imagined. Because if we did that, and then we would pour all of our resources into hospital beds that won't be used, and ventilators that won't be used, and other things that won't be used, and we will have a very poor country as a result. There's a balance between pumping up the health sector, which we need to do, and maintaining a reasonable standard of living, which we desperately need to do.
Well, that, what a really unique point is that. That's a really, really good point, Joe, is that who knows even if the next pandemic, if it's the type of pandemic that is that needs ventilators, right? Because we don't even know that we know that there'll be a COVID-25 or whatever year that might be, but we don't even know what impact that is. Maybe it is something that is not as respiratory based. Maybe it's some other medical device that we would have needed. So to some extent, what you're saying, you cannot prepare for everything in a worst case scenario. Otherwise, you'd have stockpiles around the nation for every possible event. But I don't know, what is your sense on when we get back to semi-normal economically versus totally the locomotive is back up and running?
Yeah, good question. I follow Scott's lead on this. I think it depends on the testing. I think the testing is going to ramp up this month, but we won't be there. I mean, April is the month I had in mind. May, I think, is the sweet spot. As long as we're pushing the testing as hard as we can, then sometime in May, we're going to know where we are. And I think, again, on a region by region basis, we're going to be able to gauge where it's possible to lighten up. Now, let me emphasize, by the way, that we are not in a total shutdown. If we were, then we'd be in a world of hurt. We would be Italy. We are not Italy.
That's a good point. Actually, expand on that. When you say we're not in a total shutdown, I think it's a really good point because I think optically we see our community store. When you see a store shut down, you think, oh, well, everything's shut down because we optically see not a lot of flights. We see restaurants are mostly closed except for takeout. But then again, you've got millions of people working from home and collaborating on Teams and Zoom and all these other areas. So we're not in a total economic shutdown. So that's a really good point. Tell me your sense of how shut down or partially open we are.
I think we're pretty open. But I think the CARES Act is going to be critical to this, because if you make it possible for the small business and the large businesses to keep people on payrolls, then effectively they're not shut down. They can pay their rent. They can pay their credit card bills. They can afford to do a pickup at a restaurant. They won't be getting in the restaurant, but they can afford the meal. That is not only has psychologically very positive impacts, but economically it's incredibly important, and it gives people a sense of confidence that their jobs will be there when we come around to the other side. And that's critically important psychologically. It's critically important because it gives people hope, and it makes them for those of us who work at home. We may be a little depressed because we're now seeing our kids for the first time. But we'll get used to that eventually. And eventually they'll go back to school. We all hope and pray. We're also needing to work diligently, even though we're not in our normal office space. Where we can work, we should work. We should be working as hard as we can. We need to keep that positive mental attitude and the assurance that that job is going to be there and that paycheck is coming into, you know, on a biweekly basis to our bank accounts is incredibly important. So,
well, also owning a small business, and this is, again, a small business under 500 employees, the fact that you can have a two-month loan now, or really it's 2.5 times a monthly payroll plus other expenses like rent or utilities, a mortgage on a building or your office space and some other costs, and then get a loan for that at 2.5x, and then be able to have that if you keep your payroll intact, and if you have 50 employees, let's call it the end of June or whenever the time frame ends, and you still have 50 employees, the fact that that loan can be actually forgiven is pretty incredible, I think. It's a pretty incredible development, something we've never seen in the United States.
Absolutely right. And I think that we're going to have to do that again, maybe on a selective basis. I think for much of the country, that period of time might be enough. I'm trying to be optimistic here. It would be crazy to, give businesses a 2 month or 2.5 month chance and then say, okay, we're not going to do anymore. I'm very concerned that Congress, being as dysfunctional as it is, that they might not catch on, but I think they probably will, because congressmen will all be going back home. And even though they will be 6 feet from their constituents will let them know, probably electronically, that you can't just drop the ball now.
So we may end up getting another stimulus package or relief package. You know, we might get another CARES, Coronavirus Aid Relief Emergency Security Act, which is so politically correct way of saying it's a big bridge, it's a stimulus, it's a bailout. I actually don't look at it as much as a bailout as I do a bridge to when we reopen. So again, it's so wonderful to get policy experts and economists on Money Matters like you to give us an insight on when we get. I think I love thinking of this as the downhill slide of the curve is so important. You know, we've got to slow the spread, which we're doing. We've got to selectively reopen once we have intensive testing, which we're getting there already. Then we get immunity, and then we have to prepare for the next pandemic in a smart way. I mean, I think that summarizes such a sensible plan to reopen America. And I think that also gives us some optimism that we're going to get through this without a depression. Certainly a recession makes sense, but a depression, we can avoid that. If you want to find Dr. Antos, Joe Antos, or Joseph Antos, you can find him on Twitter at Joe, J-O-E, Antos, A-N-T-O-S, Joe Antos. And of course, my Twitter at Wes Moss 365, W-E-S-M-O-S-S 365. As we continue to keep you up to date on the very leading, on the cutting edge and leading experts on figuring out coronavirus, COVID-19, and how we move forward as an economy to reopen America and get back to life, at least it's semi-normal. Dr. Joe Antos, thank you so much for your time today. It's a pleasure to have you. We appreciate your expertise helping us and our listeners through this. And we wish you to stay safe like every other American out there and continue to keep up the good fight.